We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Afghanistan, 1 year later. August is the first anniversary of the chaotic and really disastrous U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan last year that saw the Taliban take power and 13 American servicemen and women killed in the withdrawal. How is that country faring now? And what have been the consequences of that withdrawal for U.S. power and credibility around the world? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot here with my colleagues Joe Sternberg and Kim Strassel talking about Afghanistan. Is a painful subject for many, but it's being discussed widely again on the first anniversary, except for the White House, which doesn't want to say too much about it. Joe Biden hasn't had much to say about Afghanistan at all since the withdrawal, and I guess with good reason. It's, in my view, the single biggest debacle of his first 2 years. Certainly doesn't want to dilate on that very often. Let's listen to Mike McCaul. He's the House Foreign Affairs Committee ranking member and would be chairman if Republicans take the House next year.
The State Department probably didn't have the resources it needed to carry out an evacuation of this size and in Normandy. They had 36 consular officers at HKIA trying to process hundreds of thousands of people. They were overwhelmed, but there are so many mistakes. The biggest one, Margaret, for me, having lived through it, were, you know, being in the classified space, listening to the intelligence community tell the story about this is going to be imminent. It's going to fall sooner rather than later. The military said it, told us the same thing. And then we went to state, and they paint in the White House a very rosy picture. There's a disconnect between, you know, intelligence on the ground and what the White House is doing. I think in this report, this says it all. Like, there's no way we're going to evacuate embassy personnel from helicopters like we did in Vietnam. Yeah. And of course, we know that happened.
The congressman was talking about a Republican Foreign Affairs Committee report on the exit. The House Democrats haven't really wanted to investigate what happened, but the House GOP has and has issued this lengthy report, which the White House is preparing a rebuttal to. So we'll see what those have to say. But there's no doubt, Joe, that the exit was a fiasco and that the administration was not prepared for it, as Mr. McCaul says. And a lot of that has to do with the utter dogmatic determination of President Biden. We know he just wanted to get out, and he wanted to get out by a date certain. And that led almost inevitably to a rushed exit that wasn't adequately prepared for what happened when the Taliban surged to the city limits of Kabul.
Yes, and this points really to what I think is one of the big problems and also the great dangers with President Biden's foreign policy, which is that he seems to think that he is often the smartest guy in the room on a lot of these foreign policy issues that might be related to his long time looking at foreign issues when he was, you know, working on these things when he was in the Senate. But he really does seem to have been the driving force for this withdrawal. I was absolutely convinced it was the right thing to do. And that is a particularly ironic outcome, given that the two things that he was elected to do in terms of foreign policy, in contrast to the Trump administration he succeeded, was to be more competent. And then also, there was this notion that the U.S. needed to rebuild its relationships with its allies abroad. And his biggest foreign policy decision, this withdrawal from Afghanistan, exposed how hollow both of those promises were, because this was not a well-thought-out plan, either strategically or, you know, understanding what the long-term implications would be, or just planning how it would happen when they were doing it. And I think part of that also is that they have just failed to understand how this was going to look in the rest of the world, how it was going to undermine America's standing with its allies or in the eyes of our enemies.
Just to follow up on that point, Kim, that Joe makes, the operating assumption, I think, that the president had, and he was asserting this publicly, was that if the United States reduced its commitment to Afghanistan, it would be able to turn those resources elsewhere, especially to the Pacific and China, and not have to spend so much to defend against the Taliban insurgency in Afghanistan. But the flip side of that is that the way we left Afghanistan meant that U.S. credibility was really damaged, and that's the credibility about our staying power on behalf of allies. And of course, that has implications for the rest of the world. And I suspect, although I can't be sure, that this is one factor that could have influenced Vladimir Putin when he made the decision to invade Ukraine. He might have figured that the U.S. wouldn't respond with a force and aid to Ukraine that it has. He was wrong, of course, but I suspect that our Afghan exit undermined the U.S. ability to deter Putin in Ukraine.
Yeah, and I think that that's maybe just the beginning of the fallout from putting us in a position where we looked weak on the international stage. You can argue that a lot of the increasing belligerence that you are seeing from China, particularly its response recently to Nancy Pelosi's trip in Taiwan, the saber rattling and demands to speed up the timeline for when it reunifies with Taiwan could be part of this. I think the doubling down in Iran of getting to its nuclear capabilities, of telling international inspectors they cannot come in, may be tied to this. And then you add to it as well that you have to ask the question whether or not this argument that we'll pull out of Afghanistan will still have an over-the-horizon capacity and ability to monitor what's going on in that region while we turn our attention to, for instance, China. If that's really panned out, obviously the administration's doing a bit of a fist pump over the drone strike on Zawahiri, the al-Qaeda leader. But the fact that he was back in the region, living near the guest house of the powerful interior minister of the Taliban, does raise some very frightening questions about whether or not terrorist leaders are beginning to reuse the entire area as a terrorist stronghold, a way to keep out of American eyes and ears. So there's a lot of fallout from this, and we're not getting the situation that Biden promised us.
On that counterterrorism point, of course, Joe Biden had said, even going back to when he was vice president and President Obama was doing the new deployments that I think it was 2010, he announced them, that Joe Biden opposed. He said, we can do counterterrorism with an over-the-horizon strategy. And of course, they're pointing to the Ayman Zawahiri killing as an example of a successful over-the-horizon mission. And that's certainly true. It was a success. On the other hand, everything I've heard from the people who have access to intelligence, it looks like, Joe, that ISIS and al-Qaeda are both increasing their strength inside Afghanistan, using it to develop new sanctuaries there. We don't know how extensive those are, but they are real. And I think one of the signs of evidence we're seeing, particularly on the ISIS front, is the explosions that are taking place in cities like Kabul, where there are terror killings that are almost certainly by ISIS, which is competing with the Taliban for the control of the jihadist movement in that country and is trying to sow discontent in the sense that the Taliban cannot control public order.
Yeah, and I mean, why wouldn't those groups be doing that there right now? I mean, you can and should have a discussion about kind of how effectively the U.S. and allies are maintaining order themselves at various points in Afghanistan. But the reality is that when we were there, it was not a huge lawless territory that was conducive to this kind of terror activity. And this withdrawal has now created a situation where you have a country in that region with, by all accounts, seems to be an ineffective government. And to the extent that it is an effective government, it's a Taliban regime that is sympathetic to a lot of these terrorist organizations. You now create this zone that is available to those groups in a way that it wasn't before. And it's kind of tempting to think that right now they're all just there fighting each other, involved in these various obscure disputes and feuds that these groups sometimes develop between themselves. But it, I think, would be naive to assume that that is going to stay there, because it has not stayed there in the past.
Well, just elaborate a little bit on that. When the United States pulled out, it meant that the CIA listening posts in the country also pulled out. Now you lack that presence on the ground with the resources to listen in on different conversations, to locate camps where new camps develop. Now, there's no question the U.S. and the CIA retain some human intelligence capability in Afghanistan. I think that was borne out by the Zawahiri raid. In fact, people on the ground no doubt contributed to identifying where Zawahiri was and tracked his movements and so on, so the U.S. could hit him when he was out on his rooftop or balcony without doing greater damage to the neighborhood, and apparently no other casualties, which is astonishing. and very good counterterror work. But without those listening posts, you just have fewer resources to devote to counterterror, Kim.
Absolutely. And if you look at the 20 years we were in Afghanistan, we certainly used those capabilities that we had in those listening posts to good effect, obviously. And 2011, it allowed us to finally take out Osama bin Laden. It did help us being there and having that presence. Another very senior al-Qaeda leader, Abu Musab Zarqawi, we got him, countless others. But in addition to simply being able to help various Afghani presidencies help and maintain solid economy there, new opportunities for people, which obviously is very much not the case of what is happening at the moment. So you put together the list, Paul, of all the bad things that have come out of this. What you just mentioned is one, but the list is very long indeed.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have more on the political and geostrategic consequences of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan when we come back.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal with Joe Sternberg and Kim Strassel. And we're talking about the lessons of the Afghan withdrawal a year later. One point I want to make about the withdrawal is that the choice at the time was not, as some have posited, that between total withdrawal of the kind that we committed to and executed, or a long-term major commitment. There was a plan that the Pentagon had offered, that the Pentagon supported, that the State Department supported, that nearly everybody in government supported, except for the president, which was to keep 2,500 soldiers there, American soldiers, also an element of air power to back up the Afghan military and special forces. Afghan Special Forces was pretty good, and the belief was it was a doable mission, and it was, in fact, the sudden withdrawal of the U.S., particularly one night overnight, we just vanished from Bagram Air Force Base, which undermined the morale and confidence of the Afghan military and caused them to collapse. So it was an alternative mission, as the general in charge of Afghanistan has recently reinforced in comments related to the anniversary. Joe, stepping back some, what lessons do you draw from all of this about not just the withdrawal, but the mission in Afghanistan?
Well, one thing that we need to keep in mind here is that this was not just the U.S. and also not just the Afghan forces that were involved in this, because there was also a bigger issue to do with the presence of America's allies, particularly European allies there. And I think that that's sort of a way into thinking about some of the broader implications of this a year on, because I think that, you know, there was this focus, I think, within the Biden administration, as far as we can tell, on kind of what the president wanted for the U.S. presence there and for a U.S. domestic political audience and for his own preferences, you know, regarding all of that. But, you know, European allies also had a stake there, and they got hung out to dry as a result of our hasty departure, which many of them had not really been told about adequately before it happened. And so I think if you're kind of taking a step back to look at this, I think that that cooperation was in many ways a great success. You know, this was the opportunity during the 20 years that we were in Afghanistan where we had really, you know, worked on a mission that had been a big stretch for NATO at the time, because much of this was done under the aegis of our NATO allies. And it, you know, was creating an opportunity for us to continue working with those allies for a common purpose. And you have the sinking feeling over the past year that we've kind of thrown that advantage away, you know, without really thinking about the consequences.
Okay, but Joe, let me push back on that in one sense. So if you look at NATO, which was the partner with the United States in Afghanistan, some people in the administration will come back and say, well, wait a minute here. You look what happened in Ukraine. NATO is back in business, baby, and in a big way, and more effective than ever. In fact, it's adding members. So Afghan withdrawal didn't do much harm to NATO.
I think that, you know, there is a sense in which the European partners have realized after this event in Afghanistan that they kind of need to attend to their own affairs. And so I think that there is kind of this longer term problem that we're going to face, where what they have been through in Afghanistan did raise questions about America's reliability as an ally. And so it's true that NATO has enjoyed a lot of successes as an alliance in terms of the situation in Ukraine. But you'll notice that one difficulty here in a lot of countries has been actual military commitment to Ukraine, you know, whether it's a willingness to sell arms or do training or that sort of thing. That was very slow to materialize. And I can't help wonder if part of that was because there was this lingering suspicion about the American commitment to the alliance that we have had to overcome as the Ukraine situation has developed.
Let's talk about a couple of other lessons about the war and the political impact. One lesson for me is shows again that you just cannot win an insurgency when the insurgents have a sanctuary in a nearby country. In Vietnam, it was North Vietnam and, of course, Cambodia and Laos. In Afghanistan, it was Pakistan. Nearby Pakistan, we never really reckoned with the double game that Pakistan was playing, claiming to be our ally at the same time, providing sanctuary in the north frontier territories to the Taliban and even to certain Taliban leaders. Mullah Omar, Quetta, and other leaders in Quetta were ruthless enough with Pakistan to be able to stop that from being a sanctuary. And I wonder if, you know, to win a war like this, a war of insurgency, you just have to be more ruthless than the American people are willing to be when it comes to killing adversaries and going after adversaries like that in the kind of way that in our modern media world, where you see the consequences in human terms so dramatically, we're just not willing to do it. And it makes you wonder whether we can undertake the kind of commitments overseas that we have in the past.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And one thing I think that is worth noting is that we did learn a lot over 20 years, in particular our armed forces, about counterinsurgencies, putting a lot of things that had been theoretically talked about or used in small forms very much in action, and modifying how as we went along, sometimes unsuccessfully and sometimes with better success. But on the broader point that you're making, Paul, yeah, the nature of conflict across the globe has changed. And sometimes when you look at a place like what's going on in Ukraine, that was sort of shocking itself too, in that it looked as if, like, again, this almost old-fashioned war, people in tanks and traditional conflict and mortars and, you know, the whole thing. But a lot of this now is about getting bad guys that are hiding in caves and places. And it does take a new level of ruthlessness. And I just think about the last 20 years, the periodic fights in the United States over using drones to go get these guys. We weren't even talking about putting American troops on the ground, boots on the ground, but the vicious debate internally, domestically, about that form of warfare, much less, as you said, a more longstanding commitment where we actually have an actual presence. I worry about that too. And again, the Biden administration's entire argument for why we had to do this and the false premise was, well, we either had to put more people at risk on the ground or get out. I don't buy that. It wasn't really the case. But what that did signal is that President Biden was in fact responding to American weariness with this conflict after just 20 years. And thank goodness we didn't necessarily have that attitude back when we were ensuring that Germany and Japan after World War II got back on track, and we still have presence in those places. But the American people have changed in that regard, and even though the world has become a more dangerous place, and that is very concerning.
Joe, on that point, the skepticism about American involvement overseas has spread to the American right, and you see it in Donald Trump's desire to withdraw American troops from much of the world. Some of the stories we've seen in the books that have appeared, memoirs about the Trump years, talk about President Trump's desire to withdraw American troops from Germany, American troops from South Korea. And also, in particular, I know this from reporting it in real time with sources in the administration and in Congress, that he wanted a declaration before he left office on January 20th that the troops would be out completely out of Afghanistan on his watch. And so in that sense, his personal criticism of Joe Biden on the withdrawal is somewhat hollow, because I think Donald Trump, had he won a second term, would have done it as well. Now, one hopes he would have done it a lot more effectively and efficiently and a lot less chaotically than Biden did. But he was going to pull those troops out too. Joe, last word.
Yes, and I think that this is a big part of the problem that the U.S. has grappled with for a long time and is going to continue here. Since the withdrawal from the world is a luxury that you don't really have if you were the world superpower as the U.S. is. So I think that the big thing that we have to be worried about with Afghanistan now is that as events develop in the second or the third or fourth year after the American withdrawal, I think that we really have to be watchful of, you know, any danger that we're going to get that lesson again in ways that could potentially be very dangerous for America. And I hope that people in Washington will be aware of that risk before we potentially get to that point.
All right. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Joe. Thank you all for listening. We're back every day with another edition of Potomac Watch. You can send your comments and questions, cat calls, whatever, to pwpodcast@wsj.com. And we look forward to hearing from you and look forward to having you with us again for the rest of the week in Potomac Watch.